From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Eric Westerveld. It's Here and Now. Mike Pompeo faces some trouble in the Senate today. He's President Trump's pick to head the State Department, but the majority in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee opposes him. That means the committee will likely not recommend Pompeo to the Senate floor. According to the Senate Historical Office, this would be the first time a Secretary of State nominee has not received the committee's approval. President Trump expressed his frustration with the process this morning, tweeting, quote, "Hard to believe obstructionists may vote against Mike Pompeo for Secretary of State." Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron visits the White House, where he'll be treated to the first state dinner of the Trump presidency. To sort it all out, we're joined by NPR's Ron Elving. Ron, happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you, Eric.
So all of the Democrats and one Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee have been critical of Mike Pompeo, who's currently the CIA director. Is there a theme to that criticism, Ron?
Let's start with the one Republican. That's Rand Paul of Kentucky. He is the one opposed, and his theme would be the separation of powers, going all the way back to the Constitution, and particularly to the presidential eclipse of congressional controls on the power to make war, for example, other things, but particularly the power to make war. So when he questioned the nominee about this in the confirmation hearing, he was terribly unsatisfied with the answers that he got from Mike Pompeo. And as a result, he made it clear he was planning to vote against him. He will do so in committee tonight and presumably also on the floor.
But Pompeo did make that secret Easter trip to North Korea, Ron, to pave the way for this historic meeting with North Korea's leader. I mean, did that win over any senators or make things worse for him?
It probably didn't make anything worse because I think people want there to be some kind of rapprochement of some sort or another with the between the two halves of the Korean Peninsula. They see that as peacemaking in the long run. Not on the committee, though. With respect to the Democrats on that committee or Rand Paul, no one seems to have budged because of any of the Korea stuff. And what we did get, though, was a promise from one Democratic senator last week and another Democratic senator this morning saying that while they're not on the committee and they can't vote in that committee vote tonight, they're planning to vote for Mike Pompeo on the floor when it gets there.
So he is picking up some support. So his eventual confirmation really is not in doubt or no?
Not as much as it was even over the weekend, Eric, because Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has said he plans to bring it out on the floor even if the committee doesn't approve and even if that would be something of a surprise given Senate tradition. He thinks that it's time we get a Secretary of State, so he's going to bring it out, and it looks as though there would be a couple of Democrats. If McConnell does go to the floor with it, it probably means he has at least 50 votes, and 50 votes would be enough in the current Senate. With John McCain back in Arizona, there are only 99 senators voting.
Well, switching to other news, Ron, French President Emmanuel Macron is in town this week to visit the president. I mean, on paper, Ron, it doesn't seem like these two guys would hit it off. You know, they were on the same page on retaliating against Syria, but they disagree on big issues, including climate change and trade. Is this something of a surprising partnership in your view?
It is, insofar as it's going to be a partnership, we're all eager to see. They have many disagreements, as you say, but the personal relationship seems to have been positive so far. Macron has indicated he hopes to charm the American president, making him friendlier, perhaps, to the European consensus. He would certainly like to do that, and at least soften the hostility to the European Union, and especially to Muslim immigration that this administration has projected.
Is you have a sense of what the French president gets out of rebuilding this relationship or improving it with Donald Trump?
Trade is a big factor between the United States and Europe, and the European countries are afraid that in lashing out at China or other trade partners that President Trump might be angry with, he is going to inadvertently wound some of our trading partners in Europe. So that's just one way. Of course, then there's also the issue of joint defense of the Western civilization and wanting to have the United States continue to shoulder a lot of the burden for that defense.
Ron, another issue for this Monday politics soup is Supreme Court this week will hear arguments for and against the president's controversial travel ban. What's your sense of the chance, you know, the court might rule in the White House's favor?
In the normal course of things, the Supreme Court would probably rule that the president has the broad authority that he has been asserting here to suspend and restrict entry to the United States for reasons of national security. And that is what the Trump administration is arguing in this case. On the other hand, this is not exactly a normal moment for Washington or for this issue or even for the Supreme Court, because the president's own messaging has created the impression that what he is banning here is essentially a religion or some people from that religion. So it becomes something of a religious test. And, of course, the Supreme Court would not look kindly on that in those terms. So it becomes a rather tough case to call.
Ron, finally, in the few seconds we have left, Mitt Romney ran into some trouble in Utah this weekend. What is that early loss at the state level trying to get this party support tell us about today's Republican Party?
Well, first of all, Mitt Romney's probably just fine for November. Hmm. But look, most Mormons are Republican, and most Mormons prefer the Romney model of Republican to the Trump option. But not all Utah Republicans are Mormon, and many of the activists on the conservative side in that state do, in fact, like Trump a great deal. And those people were out in force this weekend.
NPR's Ron Elving. Thanks so much, Ron.
Thank you, Eric.
Well, today the FCC starts dismantling net neutrality regulations, the regs that require that internet service providers not favor any content. So when you're watching that next episode of The Crown, it could buffer endlessly or not. No one really knows yet. We do know that access and streaming issues are already an issue for rural Americans. Ali Budner from member station KRCC in Colorado Springs reports on what getting rid of net neutrality could mean for them.
Kate Vickery and her husband are horse people.
That looks like one of them's going to come visit.
They also work in tech, developing and designing software. So when they moved to Colorado a little over a year ago, they were looking for two things in a home: wide open space and a solid internet connection. They finally found a place here in Westcliff. It's a town of around 600 people, nestled in a pastoral valley between two snow-capped mountain ranges.
You know, you may still have a hard work day, life is still life, but at the end of the day, you walk out your front door and you've got mountains and horses and pasture and life is okay.
Life is okay here for Vickery because her internet is mostly good. We go into her home office and she points out the window.
Those little hills in the foreground over there have a wireless tower on them. So that's my connection.
But
if you're on the wrong side of the mountain where you've got the shadow of a hill in the way, then you don't have broadband access.
And that's the reality for most of the community here. So what will the end of net neutrality mean for Westcliff and other rural places that already face limited service? Predictions are all over the map. And many folks are still scratching their heads about what net neutrality means in the first place. Explainer videos have popped up all over the web, like this viral ad from Burger King of all places. It compares the internet to a Whopper.
So if we want a Whopper now, we have to pay $26?
Well, that's how you get it fast. That's the highest priority.
Get it?
Whopper neutrality was repealed. They voted on it.
Whopper what?
That doesn't make any sense.
Without net neutrality, the company serving up your content, in this scenario, your hamburger, will charge more unless you pay for the fast lane.
This is a bad dream right now. I just want a burger, brother. A burger!
In the internet world, that translates into, I just want to watch The Crown. Or, I want to get online and sign up for healthcare.
What net neutrality protects is content to operate freely online.
Caroline Fry is with the public interest group Common Cause. She says communities like Westcliff are especially vulnerable.
Rural Coloradans are already at a disadvantage when it comes to internet.
She says they rely more on the web for running their businesses, accessing education, news, healthcare, entertainment, you name it. But they often have fewer options when it comes to providers.
So there is more of a risk for ISPs, internet service providers, such as Comcast or Verizon, to come in and ask them to pay for accessing content.
Or slowing down and blocking website content altogether if no one is willing to pay extra. Fry says our daily lives rely so heavily on the internet now that access is a democracy issue.
This is more than just cat videos. It's more about more than just do I watch Netflix or Hulu. This is about how do I get the resources that I need to be able to participate in our society, period. It's a very big deal.
Not true, says Travis Cavula. He oversees telecommunications for the state of Montana. He says the internet relies far too much on federal subsidies, and content providers like Netflix, Google, and Apple are getting a free ride. He'd like to see those companies picking up the tab.
It's more of a content sponsorship model of the deployment of broadband.
Right now, he says, net neutrality prohibits that sponsorship, which means there's less money for innovation and expanding rural access. Getting rid of net neutrality changes that, and Kavula says that's good for everyone, urban and rural alike. He's less concerned about preserving an egalitarian World Wide Web.
I raise the possibility to ask, is that really a bad thing? I mean, wouldn't your average rural consumer prefer a high-speed broadband network where certain content, albeit was preferred, over a crappy broadband network where everything is equally slow?
Maybe the answer is already in on that. According to a number of surveys, the vast majority of Americans support keeping net neutrality in place. For Here and Now, I'm Ali Budner in Colorado Springs.
I say Greek mythology, you might say Homer's traveler Odysseus making his way home from the Trojan War, Icarus who flew too close to the sun, but Circe, maybe not so familiar. That could change. In the Odyssey, Circe is a minor character, subservient, groveling before the epic hero Odysseus, but a powerful new novel by Madeline Miller recasts Circe as a heroic feminist sorcerer who still turns men into pigs, especially when they act like them, but the groveling, not so much. We watch Circe over her eternities-long life, defying the gods, who now feel a lot like disgraced mogul Harvey Weinstein in this Me Too moment. Madeline Miller joins us from the studios of WKNO in Memphis, Tennessee. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations as you move about. I'm sure there's like a buzz around you, as people have said, is about this book. But start with why you decided to do this. I mentioned how Circe has been seen in literature. That bothered you.
It did. You know, I think that she has been really unfairly vilified. Partially, I think people sometimes confuse her with Calypso, who is the other sea goddess from the Odyssey who has an affair with Odysseus. So I totally understand the confusion. But Calypso is the one who keeps Odysseus on her island for 7 years. And Circe, although they have that initial thing where she turns his men into pigs and would have turned him into a pig, after that, actually, she's one of the most helpful deities that he comes across. Yeah. And she is very wise. She knows all about how to get past the monsters. She knows how to talk to the shades in the underworld. So I wanted to show much more of the character. When we look at her, we're looking at her through the lens of the male heroic tradition, and I wanted to widen that lens a little bit.
Well, and for those already thinking, oh my gosh, I am way too far away from my high school, you know, Greek mythology, worry not, because this reads like a Hunger Games, and there's a cast of characters in the back that you can consult. But for those who don't really know who Circe was, the daughter of the god of the sun, Helios, tell us more about her in Greek mythology.
She's most famous, of course, for the pig transformation.
Who wouldn't be?
Right, absolutely. That definitely makes your name, I think. But she also has this whole other life. She's, as you said, the daughter of the sun god Helios. She's also the aunt of the Minotaur.
The Minotaur, who was born by her sister after she mated with a bull. So the Minotaur is this, like, what, half man, half monster?
Yes, exactly. Half man, half bull. And speaking of characters who were fun to write, exploring the type of person who would give birth to the Minotaur, Circe's sister Pasiphae was fascinating.
Yes, there you go. And her family, Circe's family, doesn't particularly like her when she's growing up.
Yes, I wanted this very much, along with sort of looking at the epics, to also be the story of a woman and her family. And nobody does dysfunction like the ancient Greeks. It's another level.
Well, it's like the Sopranos or something, or or the Kardashians.
Yeah, so they, and well, you know, they never forget a slight. And if you cross them, they will punish you and your children's children on down through the generations. The Greek gods are incredibly cruel. They're very powerful. They are used to getting exactly what they want and to pursuing only their own interests and ends. And I was interested in what it would be like to grow up in that family surrounded by those type of people.
So, for instance, as she, you know, becomes a young woman and, again, is sort of shunned on the outside of this boisterous, rambunctious god family, she falls in love with a mortal, so tender, so sweet. She starts to realize she has power.
powers. She has these transforming powers, so she transforms him into a god, and he becomes a jerk.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And I think that that is what would happen if you lived your life never having to suffer, never having to wait, never having to think about anyone else except for yourself, being able to gratify your pleasures in a moment. I can't imagine that that is good for the soul.
Well, and she keeps evolving because she gets banished to this island where she has to use her own resources, which are many. How would you describe her? I mean, I said feminist.
You know, first and foremost, she is a witch, which is really separate from her divinity. And she's the first witch in Western literature. And in my opinion, what it means to be a witch is that is the word we use for women who have more power than we think they should have. Mm. And that defines Circe. And what's fascinating about her is that characters in ancient mythology, women in ancient mythology who have the type of powers that she has, usually get punished by the end of their story. They get stripped of their powers, or they get married off or killed or whatever, but they're not allowed to sort of hold on to their independence. And one of the things that is so exciting about Circe's story is that she is able to carve out this place for herself on her island of Aiaia, surrounded by her tame lions and wolves. And I sort of saw witchcraft as a big piece of that. Yeah. She has a power source that does not come from the gods, where she's able to defend herself.
You know what else also bothered me always when I was young? Because I understand you were reading this and in many languages when you were like 13 or something like that, which I was not doing. But this idea that women were sirens, they were on these islands and they were luring sailors to their death, always bugged me. You know, like you have no control and you have to cast the fact that you're attracted to her. You have to make her negative. Did that bother you?
Oh, absolutely. And that was, I think, really the seed of the whole novel, which was that I felt that this moment where, you know, Odysseus shows up on her island, she's transformed his men to pigs, he goes to confront her, and it seems like it's going to be such an exciting scene, but then he just pulls out his sword and she kneels and grovels, as you say. Mm-hmm. It was so disappointing to me because I didn't want to keep the camera on Odysseus in that moment. I wanted to turn the camera and sort of examine this through Circe's eyes. And one of the things that's so wonderful about Homer is even though you're supposed to cheer for Odysseus, you're supposed to say, yes, you know, draw that phallic sword and, you know, hold it out to her. And you're supposed to be sort of cheering for him as he forces her to yield. But I think Homer's world is so expansive that he leaves room for you to look at it from other people's perspectives.
But still, speaking of sirens, this is something that people might remember from, you know, long ago high school classes. Circe is the one who helps Odysseus when he has to go by the sirens who, you know, have these beautiful voices that draw people so they crash on the rocks. What does she advise Odysseus to do?
Well, she's the one who comes up with the idea of putting beeswax in his men's ears so that they can pass by safely. They won't be able to hear the siren song. But, and this was the part that really jumped out at me, she tells Odysseus, if you want, you can tie yourself to the mast so you will still hear it, but you won't be able to throw yourself out and you'll be able to listen to the song as your men carry you safely by. She understands Odysseus. She understands his curious, questing nature, the fact that he would love to be the only man in the world who had heard the siren song and lived. And they seem to have a very interesting relationship. As much as it was fun to explore the female characters and to give them their due, it was also wonderful to write about so many interesting male characters.
Well, and where'd you draw your story from? Odysseus and Circe have a son, Telegonus, and I understand there was an epic that had a plot that helped you, and also another poem about the voyage of Jason and the Argonauts. Mm-hmm. Circe performs this purification ritual for Jason and Medea, which is just, I mean, wacky. but you wanted to adhere to an existing storyline a little bit.
I did. There are so many myths out there about Circe and Odysseus and all these other characters who show up in the story. And I didn't just limit myself to Homer. I threw the doors open. I looked at Ovid as well. I went all the way up to Shakespeare. I went up to Tennyson's wonderful poem, Ulysses. But one of the things that I loved doing in terms of the Homer is sort of being in conversation with Homer, but having shifted that lens. So one of the things that pops up in Homer is Circe is described as beautifully tressed in terms of her hair. And I think that that is, as you were saying, sort of that's the male perspective of the alluring temptress goddess. But if you were actually a woman who was constantly in the woods and in your garden digging, you would be wearing your hair in braids. And, you know, so I wanted to kind of say, okay, the traditional Homeric version is that she has this gorgeous, sexy hair that she's just waiting around for men to show up with, mm-hmm. you know. But I wanted to say, well, how about what if her hair is like that because she's constantly working?
It's so vivid. It's so layered. You can get lost in it. Whether or not you think you like Greek mythology, it's just great storytelling. It also feels cinematic. And I'm just wondering, you know, I can picture Jennifer Lawrence as Circe. Would that disappoint you, though? Because one of the things the book has the potential to do is, you know, have people read.
Well, it is always the greatest compliment to me when people say, I read one of your books and it made me want to go on and read the Iliad or read the Odyssey. As a Latin and Greek teacher, that is just the nicest thing you can say to me. But I also have a theater background. So there's a part of me that actually really does see it as if it's happening in front of me on a stage. As I'm writing, I'm often, you know, in the scene, imagining it as if I were directing it.
Well, and we hope it includes language like this. This is Circe. She could see the vanity of the gods and the qualities of mortals. At one point, she bemoans their short lifespans. She says, no matter how vivid they were in life, no matter how brilliant, they came to dust and smoke. Meanwhile, every petty and useless god would go on sucking down the bright air until the stars went dark.
Yes, all these things that we still experience are just so vividly and beautifully portrayed in these old myths and in Homer. Hope, despair, love, grief, desire. And so even though they're monsters, that just adds to the sort of potency and excitement. But really, these are human stories, and that's what I wanted to bring out.
That's Madeline Miller. She brings it out in the new novel, Circe, the story of that goddess. Madeline, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
The Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations has asked the UN Security Council to investigate alleged Israeli crimes during ongoing protests in the Gaza Strip. Thousands of people have been gathering weekly in demonstrations along the fence that separates Israel from Gaza. Israeli soldiers reportedly killed 4 Palestinians on Friday, and at least 37 people have died since the protests began. Israel says it's trying to prevent attacks on its soldiers and stop people from breaching the fence. All this is happening as a Palestinian man is making history here in the United States. This weekend, an entire museum dedicated to Palestinian art opened in Connecticut. It's said to be the first in the Americas. David DeRoche from Connecticut Public Radio reports.
Faisal Saleh is both the curator and owner of the Palestinian Museum US in Woodbridge near New Haven.
Wow, so you got a lot of stuff to hang on the walls, I guess.
Yep, and there's more on the way.
He leads me through the halls of the museum, stopping at one installation by artist Raji Cook.
The installation on the floor here is called the Living Stones.
The white-haired Saleh points to smooth river stones scattered across the room. Each stone is covered by a photo portrait wrapped in twine. The point is that many people visit the Holy Land to see ancient sites, which he calls the Dead Stones. This exhibit invites you to think about the living.
Just to emphasize that when you visit, you should really be visiting the people, not just the stones.
Saleh assembled this installation along with works from 27 other artists for the museum's opening. Samia Halabi is one of the best-known Palestinian artists exhibiting her work here. She spoke via Skype from New York.
The way Palestinian painting will act as a powerful ambassador in the West is to show us to be a thinking, creative people rather than poverty-stricken victims.
Much of the museum's art is vibrant and feels optimistic. One part of the collection shows people in pastel colors, surrounded by whimsical shapes and textures. Others show regional traditions, an olive harvest, a coffee ceremony. There's even an homage to the prickly pear. Opening an art museum is a new venture for Saleh. By trade, he's a businessman. He founded a software company, he's been a consultant, he now runs a medical device startup. He says he's funded the museum all on his own. He wants it to be completely independent, free from any political or religious affiliations. But he recognizes that it's almost impossible for Palestinian art to not make a statement with political overtones.
There are certain things about what's going on there that are going to seep into this, no matter what you do. But most of the art we have is just art. There's no political message in it.
Though one piece of art that greets visitors captures a provocative moment. It's a memorial of sorts for Rachel Corrie, an American who was protesting the destruction of Palestinian houses in 2003 when she was killed by a bulldozer driven by an Israeli soldier. While Israeli officials dispute the circumstances of her death, Palestinians hold Corrie in high regard. Then there's an Israeli military ammunition box filled with stones. It's another piece by Raji Cook.
Palestinians throw stones. The Israelis shoot live bullets at them.
Controversy is inherent in almost anything related to Palestinians and Israelis. Despite that, Faisal Saleh hopes to make the Palestinian Museum US a welcoming place.
We're putting art on the walls, and we're reading poetry, and we're playing music. Anybody wants to join us, they're welcome. They want to talk politics, they go somewhere else, but not in, you know, that's not what we're doing here.
Saleh hopes that people come to the museum with an open mind. For Here and Now, I'm David DeRoche in Hartford.
How do you rebuild trust between communities of color and police in America? There's ongoing distrust, anger, and fear following a series of police shootings of unarmed black men. The shootings have sparked street protests, lawsuits, soul-searching, and calls for change. Stephon Clark, a 22-year-old black man in Sacramento, California, is only the latest to get national attention. Clark was shot to death last month in his grandparents' backyard by two Sacramento police officers. Many activists saw it as part of a long trend of racist police violence. In search of what police can do to change this dynamic, we turn to the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement, or NOBLE. Clarence Cox is the president, and he joins us. Mr. Cox, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Since 2015, statistics show that 25% of those killed by police were black, a disproportionate share, of course, given that African Americans are 12% of the nation's population. What do you see as the most important thing police departments should be doing right now to help reduce that violence and what many see as the implicit bias driving that?
Well, you kind of hit it on the head. We're encouraging implicit bias training to be mandated throughout the training academies across the country as well as departments, and make it mandatory for veteran officers to take as part of their annual in-service training. We're also encouraging agencies across the country to join the use of force database, which is right now voluntary. And unfortunately, out of the over 18,000 police departments across the country, when it was first piloted, less than 200 agencies participated.
Well, talk about that training. What does that look like, whether it's online or in person, and do we have any data on how effective it is?
So far, I have not seen any data on the effectiveness. However, I've seen real-time results in some of that. I actually just left New Orleans, where they're doing some interventions to include the implicit bias. You know, New Orleans has had some real issues as it relates to law enforcement in the community, and they've launched something called EPIC, the acronym for Ethical Policing is Courageous. With this program that they've rolled out in New Orleans, it's almost mandatory that people buy in, the officers buy in, and they're not going to allow others to erode the public trust any longer. They're going to report people who are, you know, abusing our citizens, doing arrest and other things, doing corrupt and unjust things.
We're speaking with Clarence Cox of the group NOBLE. I have to ask you about the Philadelphia Starbucks case. In Philadelphia, police arrested two black men recently at a Starbucks. They were waiting for a friend. The video of this arrest went viral. Starbucks has apologized and is shutting down stores in May for an afternoon of, you know, anti-bias training. Do you think an afternoon of a corporate training session will do anything to change that dynamic? Is it a start?
I think that's a start, and I think it's a very positive start. NOBLE was directly involved in this. The chief there is a friend. I reached out to him as soon as this happened and wanted to know his thoughts on it before I released the statement. When he made an apology, I called him back and applauded his apology and told him that was the beginning of the healing. We also spoke with the Starbucks folks. We spoke with them because NOBLE participated in what was called a coffee with a cop, and where we invited the community into Starbucks to you know, have town hall meetings. So my statement to Starbucks immediately was, we've sent a mixed message to our community, and we've got to make this right. And, you know, the CEO and others there agreed. And my point to them was, I know the culture and I know the philosophy of management, but if that's not sent down to the organization, it's problematic. And in this case, apparently it was not.
Finally, what do you think can be done to help rebuild trust? What's the most effective avenue? Are we talking community forums, town meetings, one-on-one? What, in your experience, is the most effective?
Well, I went back to Ferguson recently after the live trucks and everybody had gone, because we were there when Michael Brown, right after the Michael Brown incident, and I learned a lot from that. People are still, in a sense, hurting and trying to heal, though things have changed and things are progressively better, and they're getting better every day. But what we have done a bad job of doing in law enforcement, in any community across this country, if their agency head isn't practicing some of the tenets under the 21st century policing, they have a problem. We've got to get everybody on board. And until there is some real reform in law enforcement and the criminal justice system, we've got to do it locally. And we can't depend on the White House or anybody. We've got to start locally. And that's why I applaud the things that are going on in New Orleans. They're doing it locally.
Clarence Cox is president of the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement, or NOBLE. Clarence, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Let's take up racial bias in policing in another time. President Trump tweeted this weekend that he got a call from actor Sylvester Stallone asking him to grant a posthumous pardon to the boxer Jack Johnson, who died in 1946. Johnson was the first African-American world heavyweight champion, and he was the target of a racially motivated arrest more than 100 years ago. President Obama was also pushed to pardon the boxer. He didn't. So who was Jack Johnson? Jesse Washington is senior writer for ESPN's The Undefeated. Jesse, give us the thumbnail on Jack Johnson, known as the Galveston Giant.
Okay, so the first black heavyweight champion was a very controversial and a wild guy. He loved fast cars, flashy jewelry. He also loved white women at a time when black men were lynched for even looking at them. And he was abusive to these women. He beat them.
Well, and some say this is why maybe President Obama didn't pardon him.
That's a major reason why. The image that Jack Johnson had then was the image that a lot of rappers have now. So imagine Obama pardoning someone like Tupac or Bobby Shmurda. A big part of the electorate would have used an Obama pardon to confirm pre-existing and false ideas about the nature of black culture and even the motivations of a black president. So it's no surprise that Obama stayed away from it. Yeah,
but, I mean, on the other hand, this is at the turn of the last century. Johnson beat the Canadian fighter Tommy Burns, gets the heavyweight title, and Americans want the great white hope to restore the white supremacy. So a former champ, Jim Jeffries, comes out of retirement. He says, I'm going to demonstrate that a white man is king of them all, but Jack Johnson, you know, wins. And the Los Angeles Times writes an editorial, a word to the black man, do not point your nose too high. Do not swell your chest too much. Remember, you have nothing at all. You are just the same member of society you were last week. That's a Los Angeles Times editorial. One would think that a pardon is in order for how he was treated. Maybe, you know, maybe he was a black man on, you know, that with a reputation people didn't like, but he was a black man talked to like that.
It's amazing that it really went down like this, and it reminds us how far we've come from that time when the racism was so prevalent. After he defeated the Great White Hope, there were riots across the country, and several dozen black people were killed because of the victor. Oh. So it's hard to even comprehend the atmosphere during that time, which was why they literally said, we can't beat Jack Johnson in the ring, so we're going to lock him up outside of it.
Well, what exactly did they lock him up for? He was convicted by an all-white jury in 1913, violating the Mann Act. That makes it illegal to transport women across state lines for immoral purposes. Now, he had been married to a white woman who he beat. She killed herself. And then the charge came because of his relationship with a white prostitute?
That's correct. It was a consensual relationship, and there was nothing coercive about it at the time. And they concocted this charge in order to send him to prison, which they did, and he was sentenced to Leavenworth. The important thing to know about this is that Jack Johnson was sent to prison unjustly. It was an early version of mass incarceration. So now, should Jack Johnson be pardoned? Well, an injustice was done to him, so yes. Mm-hmm. But there is the question of what good would it do, and more importantly, what message does it send?
Well, you quote researchers who say maybe not that much of a message to the Black community who've known for a long time about this injustice. But people like Ken Burns, who made a documentary about Jack Johnson, say it's the message to the white community, a reminder that this happened.
Absolutely. And I think it has always made a lot of sense to me that a white president would be much more likely to pardon Jack Johnson. An Obama pardon would have forced him to expend a lot of political capital.
At a time when President Obama was focusing on pardoning those wrongly incarcerated today.
Absolutely. And so for a white president to pardon Jack Johnson, it goes along with what Ken Burns said. It's helping white people. In some ways, it's probably helping them to feel good about doing something to right their sins of the past.
Jesse Washington, senior writer for ESPN's The Undefeated. Jesse, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's get an update now on the two Reuters reporters who've been in custody in Myanmar since December. Wa Lone and K Seo were detained while they were reporting on the Rohingya crisis, Myanmar's crackdown on minority Muslims. Myanmar's government said it was targeting insurgents, but the United Nations top human rights official described the violence as ethnic cleansing. The BBC's Nick Beek is following the case. He joins us from Yangon, the capital of Myanmar. Nick, thanks for being here.
Pleasure, Eric.
These reporters have been in jail for more than 4 months. Remind us, Nick, why were these reporters detained in the first place?
Yeah, Eric, I mean, this is a story of two young Burmese journalists who say their only crime was doing their job. And, you know, many people think that it's actually journalism in the dock here in Myanmar today. They were detained under this extremely old colonial era legislation back from 1923, the Official Secrets Act. It was said that they'd received these secret documents after meeting police officers, and so they were arrested. And as you say, they've been in detention ever since. Week in, week out, we've had these legal hearings. But the reality is they remain behind bars today.
There was some testimony last week, Nick, that was favorable to the reporters. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this was an extraordinary moment. We've had this procession of witnesses giving pretty dull testimony in a lot of cases. And it was supposed to be just another witness for the prosecution. A police captain, Mo Yanai, turned up in court, but what he said stunned everyone, because when he got up to speak, he said that the Reuters journalist had in fact been set up. He said that a superior had instructed him to find a way of supplying documents to them so that they could then be arrested. And people couldn't quite believe what they were hearing at this point. Afterwards, as you can imagine, journalists swarmed around him saying, look, why have you done this? Why did you say this? And he said, the reason I told the truth is no matter what rank we are in the police force, we have our own principle, we have our own morality. And so this has opened a whole can of worms, but we don't quite know what the impact of this will be. This particular police officer is himself in a prison cell as I speak to you, because he has been implicated in what is an extremely complex case.
So he was then jailed, but we've got this testimony of potential entrapment, but we don't know the impact on the case of that testimony?
Yeah, absolutely right. On Wednesday, the judge will decide whether or not to throw out this evidence, this bombshell story, because the prosecution have said, look, hey, we weren't expecting this. This is a hostile witness. So if the judge decides that this evidence isn't admissible, it could be that it's dismissed, you know, it's scrapped from the record. And this policeman, after saying what he said, could himself face further charges. He's been in detention for 4 or 5 months. He's said to be complicit in this operation. So what happens now is hard to say. And, you know, a lot of people have given up trying to predict what happens next.
These reporters were investigating the persecution of the minority Rohingya. What is Reuters saying about the case right now?
Well, Reuters have said from the start that it's outrageous that these two reporters of theirs have been detained in this way. They say all along they've been doing their jobs professionally. Just to remind people, this was a story they're investigating. It was the alleged massacre of 10 Rohingya men in Rakhine State. So this is the part of Myanmar where they've had all the military crackdown in the last 6, 7, 8 months, and some 700,000 mainly Muslim Rohingya people have fled to Bangladesh. And, you know, Reuters say it's no coincidence that their reporters were picked up at a time that they were investigating the Burmese military for this. And in another twist in this case, it emerged about a week ago that the Burmese military had actually sentenced 7 officers for murder as part of this case. So the Reuters guys have been saying, look, we're vindicated. Our journalism was correct, and it's a farce that we're still in prison. We exposed these murderers here, these soldiers. They got 10 years each, and we face 14 years each.
Nick, Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Prize winner, who is Myanmar's de facto leader, has faced some searing criticism over the treatment of the Rohingya. Has she taken any substantive steps yet to end the crisis or support this minority?
Well, certainly she has faced widespread international criticism, and it seems that that criticism has bounced off. We know that she was someone who was praised across the globe for her stance on human rights, her fight for democracy. In this part of the world, they used to call her Asia's Mandela. Such was the esteem in which she was held. She got the Nobel Peace Prize. But she's remained completely silent on the issue. And also on the case of the Reuters journalist, she's remained quiet too. She hasn't intervened in any way, hasn't given her opinion. And when someone did try to raise it with her, the former US diplomat, politician Bill Richardson, he said that she became so angry, he thought that she was going to hit him. So that is one story we've heard related to this.
A free press on trial in Myanmar. The BBC's Nick Beek speaking with us from Yangon. Nick, thanks so much.
Really good to talk to you, Eric.
Here and Now is a production of NPR News and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.